The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have quite a lot to get to today. It seems like all week it's just been a challenge assembling everything, and we don't even have classes going on. So what's it going to be like when school resumes, Sam? You'll have to double up. That's what we'll do. We're keeping an eye on tensions in Jerusalem, of course. We've talked a lot about that these last couple of days. We do have just some fresh audio. A sound bites, not a lot of real violent activity, but there has been some protesting in and around the Temple Mount, and then also I think some rubber bullets were fired to put back some of the protesters. But here's a little bit of a montage of that. That's happening just outside the Temple Mount just a little bit ago. The Jerusalem Post, I'll just read from one item. Lots of stories, of course, on the Post and the Times of Israel. Not as much in the international news media, surprisingly. In any event, this is a headline. The head of the Islamic body, 1.7 billion Muslims say no to metal detectors. We've talked a lot about the center of the controversy is just these two very simple metal detectors. Well, maybe there's more than two. In any event, the whole Muslim world is up in arms because of it. Israel's reaction to that terrorist attack last Friday says here the head of the Waqf Muslim Religious Trust in Jerusalem saying he was speaking in the name of all Muslims worldwide on Friday rejected the security cabinet's decision not to remove metal detectors at the entrance of the Temple Mount compound. So Prime Minister Netanyahu and the MKs there are under a lot of pressure to remove those metal detectors. And he says, this leader of the Waqf Muslim Religious Trust, he's saying he's speaking on behalf of all 1.7 billion. This was at a press conference in East Jerusalem earlier today. He said, we are one. We all reject the measures to put in metal detectors. We reject the entrance of settlers to the mosque compound. We in Jerusalem represent 1.7 billion Muslims who say in one voice no to metal detectors. And again, you could listen to that and say that, well, he's exaggerating. But as we've noted before, and you put the Jerusalem and Prophecy booklet together with the King of the South, I mean, Jerusalem, as I said yesterday, is the powder keg. And so it's not just an issue that pertains to the Palestinians in and around Jerusalem. I mean, the whole Muslim world is watching. And I told you a little bit yesterday about how the Jordanian parliament reacted. I mean, that's Jordan. That's a moderate Arab nation. It's something that we've got to watch. Watch Jerusalem, as I said a few times yesterday. Watch Jerusalem. We're going to hopefully tape a program, if we have time, later on this afternoon on this subject, taking some of that material from yesterday and the day before and then the very latest to put together a program on this subject and one in which we can offer, hopefully, the Jerusalem and Prophecy booklet, which I don't think that we've offered here in quite a while, if ever. It's been a couple years now that we've been on TV. In any event, it'll be good to get that booklet out there, and I've got some thoughts about the King of the South booklet, how we'd like to promote that this summer as well. So some of those stirring booklets on prophecy, it would be good to get that out to our television audience. Well, speaking of our audience, thetrumpet.com. Yesterday, it had its busiest day of traffic of the year. Now, that was mostly due to one article that was passed around on Facebook. And I'll come to that article, the one that that got quite a lot of attention yesterday, a little bit later on in the program. I'd like to first draw your attention to another article that's at thetrumpet.com right now. It's featured, I believe, at the top of the page. It's my father's latest, The Fall of the British Royal Family. The Fall of the British Royal Family. That is a powerful article. It's going to be the personal in the forthcoming September issue of The Trumpet magazine. That magazine's already, if you haven't received it in your mailbox yet, it's already been posted online. And those articles in the magazine are rolling out on thetrumpet.com. That's the one we're featuring today, my father's latest. And in that piece, I mean, he talks about just how bad of a year it's been for Britain. It's been a bad year for Britain and the royal family. And of course, we know from Bible prophecy that it's going to get much worse before it gets better. It will get much worse. I think it was yesterday or the day before we linked to another article at our website. This is, I think, a blog posting for Handelsblatt Global. That's a German publication. And this is one of its, I guess, one of its editors. And he says here, today I'm writing, this is from Wednesday, I believe. He says, I'm writing from London, a city with a severe hangover. This is a German commentator. And he says here, a huge dark cloud hangs over the future of Britain. A year after its decision to leave the European Union, and a couple of days after officials have begun Brexit negotiations, it says some Brits now draw comfort by looking back to the past, a past when Great Britain really was great. Back then, at its largest, the empire governed 20% of the world's population and 25% of its land area. And he says that was 95 years ago. Look at how fast it's changed. How dramatic the change has been in less than a century. That was just a century ago. You think about all of the thousands of years of human history. And then this, the greatest empire in the history of the world, Great Britain, a time when it was great. Less than a century ago. There was a YouGov poll yesterday, by the way, that said that by 3-1, British people think that the British Empire is something that they can be proud of. And the article was put together as if, you know, as if they were almost surprised by that. Well, how could you be proud of the empire? The piece, this is from YouGov.co.uk, it says, Britain has long found it difficult to evaluate its former empire. Maybe I didn't include that in my notes. It just talked about how that educators and leaders in so many ways have really attacked that history. And it points out how that young people in particular are less likely to feel that pride. I mean, they're products of the educational institutions. They're coming out and they're not proud of that history. It's mostly the older generation that's proud of it. It says further on in the study, a third of British people also say that they would like it if Britain still had an empire. 45% say, no, we don't want an empire. So, I mean, this is being played as if it's a pretty positive thing. Like, well, hey, at least for the most part, we're proud of our history. I guess it's just depending on how you look at it. It's so bad today. I mean, they've fallen so far. But to be in the position that they're in, and then for nearly half of them to say, you know, no thank you, I don't want the empire. Oh, no. I wouldn't want to be part of the most powerful empire in the world. What other nation says that? What other nation concludes that? Well, here is this Handelsblatt writer. He may have a little bit of a bias. Germany's upset that the UK left and took its economy with it. But here he is saying now he's writing about a sickness. He says now the UK, this is back to that Handelsblatt piece, now the UK depends on imports, unable to produce the food, medicines, and cars it needs. Since the day that 52% of British voters chose to leave the EU, the pound has lost 16% of its value compared to the euro. Economic growth has slowed to 0.2% compared to the previous year. Bloomberg just published a set of 10 economic warning signals to show Britain is near a tipping point. He says car sales have decreased by 10% since last year. These German and French defense contracts, they're passing by British aerospace. Wages are increasing slower than inflation in Britain. That means a loss in real wages for millions of Brits. And of course, what he's getting at here is that all those people that thought that leaving the EU would solve everything, it's not exactly turning out that way. And well, he probably thinks that they've got to get back. They've got to, as one commentator said, they've got to exit from Brexit. Brexit exit. They've got to redo it. They've got to get back into the EU to solve the problems. I mean, what is happening to Britain? It doesn't matter which direction they go, but nothing's working. Nothing's working. 95 years ago, the most powerful empire in the world. The most powerful empire in the world, in world history. But after two world wars that pretty much decimated the strength of this great power, the strength of its manpower, we've seen what in those 95 years? Well, the slow and steady process of Britain devolving its empire and Commonwealth. We've seen this decades-long experiment to try to hitch itself to a uniting Europe, and now they're wanting out. And of course, we've seen a complete revolution in morality, in culture, in religion, and Britain now finds itself on the outside, sidelined, languishing in minor power status. And all of these bad things keep happening. You know what the title to that Handelsblatt piece is? This blog posting? I should have written down the author. But he titled this piece, Visiting the Sick Man of Europe. Where have we heard this before? Visiting the Sick Man of Europe. He concluded his piece saying, Britain is suffering from a major shortage of confidence. The country is the new sick man of Europe and is the author of its own destruction. Stinging words in that little piece titled, Visiting the Sick Man of Europe. Where have we heard that before? Well, we heard it from Herbert W. Armstrong. He was talking about this decades ago. We've got a clip here from, I think this is from his old radio program, which if it is, it's from back in the 1960s. This is Mr. Armstrong.
And by the end of World War I, the United States and Great Britain owned and possessed more than two-thirds and almost three-fourths of all the great wealth, the cultivated wealth of all the world. And all the other nations, Russia with her billion people, I mean China with her billion, and India, with nearly a billion, more than three-quarters of a billion people, and Russia, the third largest nation in the world, and Japan and Indonesia and others that are have vast populations, and all the nations of Europe, Germany and France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, all of the nations combined had only a little over one-fourth and less than a third of the wealth of the world. And our two nations possessed it. We had the sea gates of the whole world, and we're losing them. And Britain has already lost her world empire. Now then, I want to show you in prophecy what God said he would do to Britain and the United States after we had come to that wealth which God promised to Abraham and which he gave us.
That's Herbert Armstrong. That there would have been from the 1980s. But there he was, some 25, 35 years ago, talking about Britain's demise, paraphrasing some of the things he wrote about early on in his ministry in the United States and Britain in prophecy. I mean, that book goes all the way back to the 1930s. And then you follow the history of the Plain Truth magazine, his flagship magazine, and all of the warnings that you read in that particular publication in the 1950s and 60s, the 60s in particular, detailing all of Britain's considerable woes at the time, the economic problems, the struggles defining its commonwealth, the social tensions and unrest, the unsustainable welfare system, and of course all of the immoral entertainment, the gross immorality. You can read through those old Plain Truths and read about the sick man of Europe, which was the exact title of that Handelsblatt post on Wednesday. The sick man of Europe. Warning after warning after warning. Here's an example from December 1964. It says, relations between Britain and Europe will continue to deteriorate until the Lord shall bring a nation against you from far. This is quoting from Deuteronomy 28 now. Which shall not leave you corn, wine, or oil. He shall besiege you in all your gates. The Plain Truth piece says, these prophecies reveal a soon coming siege, a trading block of modern day Israel, a siege coming upon our nations. Of course, we've talked a lot about that as well at thetrumpet.com, particularly in recent years, especially over the last year or so with the emergence of Donald Trump. You can see the trade war coming. You can see the coming siege, a trading blockade, as the Plain Truth put it, back in 1964. It said here, this is 1964, of all the nations that compose modern-day Israel, none is more vulnerable to such a trade embargo than the United Kingdom. Now, you just read it in Handelsblatt, or I read it to you. I mean, they rely on imports for everything. The UK depends on imports, unable to produce the food, the medicines, and the cars that it needs. I mean, it used to lead the world in automobile production. I had a program on that, I think, last summer, after we visited that museum in Coventry. It says here, under present conditions, this is from 1964, the British Isles are entirely unable to feed their population without massive food imports. This is the Plain Truth in 1964. This is 50 years ago. Even during the strenuous agricultural efforts of World War II, Britain was able to produce barely half her food requirements. Since then, population has increased, farming land diminished. So, well, of course, what they were getting at there is, what happens when a trade blockade is put in place? What happens during a trade war? I mean, relatively speaking, these are still fairly prosperous times. But you can take note of the direction, as that author at Handelsblatt pointed out. The Plain Truth in 1964 said that, well, the British public, though, even in the midst of all of these problems, the British public remains apathetic. Or if they do get riled up about something, it's, the government needs this program, or we need these benefits, or these pensions, or these allowances. If the problems were that bad in 64, what are we facing today? There was a piece just today, in fact, in the news gathering. The guy's pulling together the news for me. UK crime hits highest level in a decade. This is from the Times just today, just this morning. Rising violence has helped to push crime to its highest level in a decade, with almost 5 million offenses in the past year. It says violent crime increased by 18%. Knife crime, gun offenses, and robbery helped to drive up overall crime by 10% in England and Wales. It was the largest annual increase in overall police recorded crime in a decade. And separate figures showed that officer numbers had fallen to their lowest level for more than 30 years. So they're both going in opposite directions. Surprise, surprise. As the institution of family has been virtually destroyed, and you see crime skyrocketing, the same is true in the United States. We talked about Chicago recently. And we see a reduction in the police force, or pulling back in the case of the United States. But to just focus in on the UK here for a moment, as my father says in the article we're featuring right now at thetrumpet.com, make sure you get to the website today and read that article in its entirety. It's really been a rough year for the UK, as my father writes. It has been a rough year. Look at all of the terrorist attacks. The one in March on Westminster Bridge. And then another one in June, killing eight. And before that, of course, there was the bombing in Manchester. And we've played before that clip of the London mayor following some of these attacks, saying, you know, we don't know where all of these former ISIS fighters are located. There's hundreds of them. And you'll recall the host of that morning show asking the mayor point blank, where are they? Where are these terrorists? Well, we don't know. We don't have the resources. We don't have the funding. We don't have the funding to fight this war. That's really what the other article at thetrumpet.com, the one that got some traction in Facebook circles yesterday, The Bleak Future of the Royal Marines by Abraham Blondeau. This elite unit that's won all kinds of praise for decades. I mean, Winston Churchill just praised them up and down. But there's just not enough funding to keep them going or to expand that operation. So they're having to pull back. This is the story everywhere that you look. And then you throw in the occasional disaster. Grenfell Tower. Burning down, burning to the ground not that long ago. Middle of June. Nearly 100 people dying in that tragedy. A few days after that, by the way, the Queen had a birthday celebration in downtown London, St. James Park, and she took her carriage, and it was supposed to be a celebratory event. And she came into that celebration releasing this statement first. She said, "Today is traditionally a day of celebration. This year, however, it is difficult to escape a very somber national mood. In recent months, the country has witnessed a succession of terrible tragedies." I mean, she senses the mood in the country. And it's hard at times to even celebrate. It's like the plain truth. Back in 1964, saying, here's all these problems. And yet, where are the solutions? And overall, the public is, for the most part, apathetic. Well, as I say, make sure that you spend some time today and go to thetrumpet.com and read that new article by my father, The Fall of the British Royal Family. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can send an email to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
There was a Newsweek piece while I was in America. This interview, I guess this journalist had followed around Prince Harry for the better part of a year. And the real stunning statement that came out from that interview was when Prince Harry said that, well, following Queen Elizabeth II, I don't think there's really anyone in the royal family who even wants to be king. You talk about, again, the general state of apathy or indifference. I don't even know if there's anyone that wants to be king. That's the direction that Britain's royal family is headed in. Are we witnessing the fall of the British royal family? We are. We certainly are. Back in, when was it? I think this was from April or May. It's kind of an older article now, but it's earlier in the year from The Spectator. The title, Made in Windsor, How Kate, William, and Harry Became Britain's Biggest Reality TV Show. It's just a big, it's all about celebrity. It's like reality TV. That's what you get. And TV celebrities, of course, are popping up in those circles, right and left. And there's scandals that have emerged here and there. Prince William suing that French magazine because it published pictures of his wife topless. It says here in the article, the younger royals are just too interested. This is from the British Spectator. They're just too interested in the cringe-inducing world of celebrity and in the popularization of their own image. At times, it's hard to tell the difference between the real-life entertainment provided by the princes and those structured reality shows, such as Made in Chelsea or The Only Way is Essex, in which fake people act out real and trivial events, which become drawn-out sagas. It says here, yet the younger royals have been acting up in a way not quite seen before. I mean, what we're seeing is unprecedented, in other words. Look at their Heads Together campaign. Made in Windsor, the charity special. They want to try to bring greater awareness to mental health. And this article talks about Prince William getting on a video conference with Lady Gaga to try to solve the problems of mental health. It says, along with their advisors, Kate, Will, William, and Harry appear to think that their job is to rebrand the monarchy in the 21st century, as the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh did in the 20th, to make it ever more accessible and democratic. They want to have it both ways with the media, the Spectator writes, to guard their privacy and advertise their feelings. They want to tell the world about their intimate sufferings, but they don't want the world intruding in their lives. One big reality show. It's all about the celebrity. There was a piece that came out just today about Prince William and his wife, Kate, and their love for the Game of Thrones, that series, I think, on HBO. In any event, they were in Berlin, and they saw one of the actors, I guess, that's on this program or this television show. And they tried to persuade this actor to give them some insights into what upcoming episodes will reveal. They wanted to get some spoilers. And it quotes this 44-year-old actor as saying about Prince William and Kate Middleton, as saying they said they really liked Game of Thrones and they've watched every series. And then the actor even said, I'm surprised they have time to watch such a long-running series. That's what the actor thought. I'm surprised they even have time. Well, it says here, Prince William and Kate revealed their love of Game of Thrones back in April when they told Radio 1 DJ Scott Mills that they loved watching box sets of the show. And then at the end of the article, it says William and Kate aren't the only royals who are rumored to be fans of the Game of Thrones series. The Queen was pictured touring the set in Belfast and stopped for a moment to admire the Iron Throne, whatever that is, but evidently the Queen has been up there to visit the set as well. The Game of Thrones. What is the Game of Thrones? Well, I had to do a little searching online to figure out. Here's a piece by Matthew Walther from The Week. Just last week, I guess it was. He says here, Game of Thrones is bad and it's bad for you. The real problem with Game of Thrones is not that it is, like most American popular culture these days, fundamentally adolescent. It's that it's obscene. It's not just bad art. It's art that is bad and bad for you. It's bad for you. And he talks about all the different kinds of violent acts that take place, rapes. Right there on television for everyone to see. I guess 23 million regular viewers. He concludes by saying, what does it say about our culture and the state of the souls of millions who participate in it that anyone could find any of this even mildly diverting, much less praise it as a triumph of man's creative energies and subject it to endless hours of analysis and speculation. I mean, that's the way it's seen today. This is a triumph of man's creative energies. And as this fellow writes at The Week, half a century ago, when our absurdly generous obscenity laws were still occasionally enforced, a program like this could not have been conceived, much less produced, at great expense and broadcast. A half century ago, why, this would have been considered obscene. The government would have cracked down on this. As it is, what is the government cracking down on? Well, I've been discussing that with you this week. The kinds of things that they're implementing, the kinds of things that they are enforcing. for advertising or whatever else, go back and listen to some of those earlier programs in the week. I don't have time to just rehash everything here. But look at how much it's changed. And what does it say about our culture when you have millions and millions and millions of people participating in this, viewing this kind of thing every single week, week in and week out, whether here in Britain or in the United States? You may have seen that story yesterday from the States down in Florida, these teens that filmed this handicapped individual that was drowning in a lake and screaming for help. And the teens were on the shoreline there just laughing and ridiculing this man who died right in front of them. And they recorded the incident. They didn't help the man. They didn't report it to the authorities. I mean, they only found the wife of this poor man that died only found out because he went missing. And 2 days later, then he was discovered. But here are these teens in this Game of Thrones culture just laughing it up, saying, hey, what, you're going to drown out there. What are you in the lake swimming for? There's a scripture in Paul's final epistle to Timothy that talks about man lacking even natural affection. Is that describing our society today? I mean, where does it go from here? We've talked a little bit today about what's happened from the 50s and 60s on through to today. Then my father's article, The Fall of the British Royal Family, I mean, that talks about how it's especially bad this year for Britain. The Bible also speaks of God as making or unmaking nations. We're seeing some things unravel right before our eyes. The thing of it is, as I played for you, Mr. Armstrong said that this would happen. He based his statements on the sure prophecies of God. He said in 1966, well, this was in The Plain Truth. I don't know if it was Mr. Armstrong or one of his writers. But from 1966, the big question, what will it take to wake up the people of Britain? That's the big question. What will it take? How is Britain going to wake up to what's happening? The prophet Hosea, this is from chapter 5 of his prophecy. It says, I know Ephraim and Israel is not hid from me. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God. See, we've left God for our many, many, many sins. And God is saying, well, okay, you can go that direction, but I've fulfilled my promise. This is in the U.S. and Britain in prophecy. I've fulfilled my promise of bestowing all of those blessings that I promised to Abraham. And now it's on you to keep them, to hold on to them. Have we done that? This article by Abraham Blondeau, The Bleak Future of the Royal Marines. This is one of dozens and dozens of these types of stories that just seem to be coming out every month. He says here at the start of his article, the Royal Marine Commandos are among the most elite troops in the world. Since Charles II created them in 1664, they have fought in every major war for Great Britain. Among their greatest moments were the bold seizure and heroic defense of Gibraltar during the War of Spanish Succession in 1704, the raid of Zeebrugge in 1918, and the three-day, 100-mile march during the Falklands War to capture Port Stanley. The reputation and the traditions of the Royal Marines impressed Sir Winston Churchill so much that he said the long, rough, and glorious history of the Royal Marines has shown that they have achieved much. They will achieve much more, Churchill said. They are a formidable and versatile company of warriors, as highly trained as any the world has seen. Well, Abraham goes on to quote from the Times of London, which says that there's no money now to send these Marines off to get cold weather training, which happens to come at a time when Russia is making these great advances across the Arctic. And the Times brings that out. The Times says the annual exercise, this cold weather training, involving up to 700 Marines is a vital part of commando training, but the Royal Navy is struggling to plug a gap of at least 500 million pounds in its budget. This is a disaster for recruitment and retention, a defense source said. There is no money. There's no money. There was another article, I forget where it is here in my notes, but here these Chinese warships are coming through, I think, the English Channel, and the UK had to struggle just to try to shadow them. I mean, they can't even defend their own territory. And there's cutbacks and reductions. When it comes to defense, it's the same story in the United States. I've got a couple of other stories here that I could get into on that as well, maybe next week. The same story, though. It says, this is at the end of Abraham's article. The Royal Marines are just one such proud military institution of the English-speaking peoples that is suffering from declines. Talks about the American Marine Corps. It says, while the warriors are still willing to fight and sacrifice, it is clear our societies are war-weary and no longer united against our enemies. Not only do government budgets undermine the strength of our armed forces, but they also corrupt the culture of our people. Well, he leads it right into the United States and Britain in prophecy. There was a quote, I think, somewhere in the article, too, about saying, well, I think this is actually from another article. Again, I guess I'll have to get to some of these other pieces on Monday or Tuesday. In any event, it's the same trend on both sides of the pond. What is it going to take for our people to wake up? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll take another short break and then come back to conclude the program.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
At the start of the show, I referenced that Handelsblatt piece where the author, on a trip to London just recently, said that he was visiting the sick man of Europe, and he said in that post how that there might be some Brits who draw comfort by looking back to a past when Great Britain really was great. And then he summed up its greatness this way, saying that at its largest, the empire governed 20% of the world's population and 25% of its land. That was 95 years ago. And from that YouGov poll, I mean, evidently there's still a majority in Britain who are at least proud of that history. But what will it take to wake them up? And look at how dramatic the decline has been in 95 years. Look at how dramatic it's been even since Queen Elizabeth was crowned back in 1952 or 53, I forget which year. I just want to play for you. We've played this before on a video we produced 2 or 3 years ago. It's from the coronation ceremony, and it's about 3 minutes long, and you'll hear some from the ceremony itself and then some from the narration. But this particular section that we'll play, you'll see just how it all revolved around the Holy Bible. The Holy Bible. And at one point, it calls the Bible, God's Word, it calls it the most valuable thing which the world affords. And the particular queen being crowned in this coronation ceremony is the one that is still on the throne today in her 90s. It's pretty amazing. It, in itself, it demonstrates just how far removed we are from the great creator God who authored the Holy Bible. This is from, again, Queen Elizabeth II's coronation back in the early 1950s.
Will you, to the utmost of your power, maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel? Will you, to the utmost of your power, maintain in the United Kingdom the Protestant Reformed religion established by law? Will you maintain and preserve inviolable the settlement of the Church of England and the doctrine, worship, discipline, and government thereof as by law established in England? And will you preserve unto the bishops and clergy of England and to the churches there committed to their charge all such rights and privileges as by law do or shall appertain to them or any of them?
All this I promise to do.
She goes now to the altar to confirm before God the promises which she has made. The things which I have here before promised, I will perform and keep. The Queen kisses the Bible and subscribes the oath.
The things which I have here before promised, I will perform and keep. So help me God.
For the first time in the many times of this ancient ceremony, Scotland's church takes part. The moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland receives the Holy Bible from the Dean of Westminster and brings and presents it to the Queen.
Our gracious Queen, to keep your majesty ever mindful of the law and the gospel of God as the rule for the whole life and government of Christian princes, we present you with this book, the most valuable thing which the world affords.
Here is wisdom, this is the royal law, these are the lively oracles of God.
That's from Queen Elizabeth II, her coronation back in 1952. That was the last one. You can go back, though, before that one. You could go back a long time. Many books have been written about the details revolving around the coronation ceremony. If you go back to 1689 for the coronation of William III, 1689, a few centuries ago, it says, then shall the Dean of Westminster take the Holy Bible from off the altar and deliver it to the Archbishop, who with the rest of the bishops going with him shall present it to the King and the Queen, first saying these words to them. You just heard the words there from 1952. The Queen kissing the Bible. The Archbishop saying, we present you with the book, this book, the most valuable thing that this world affords. It was intended to keep her and her kingdom ever mindful of the law and the gospel of God as the rule for the whole life and government of Christian princes. He said, here is wisdom. This is the royal law. These are the lively oracles of God. That was from 52, the one in 1689. I mean, there was another presentation of the Bible in that ceremony as well. And then these words, the archbishop said this, "Thus says the Lord of old to his peculiar people through his servant Moses, when your king sits upon the throne of the kingdom, he shall write him a copy of this law in a book, and it shall be with him. And he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal his God, and to keep all the words of this law to do them, and that he turn not aside to the right hand nor to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children." That's basically a paraphrase from Deuteronomy 17. You can go back and study that on your own. We've read it before on this program. A king's duty. He can't be selfish. A royal monarch cannot be in it for self. He can't go and acquire his own horses and women and so on and just make it about his rule, his reign. He's got to be a real servant. Make sacrifices, and of course, grounded in the law. In ancient Israel, I mean, and this was referenced in a British coronation ceremony, Deuteronomy 17, where the king's duty is listed there for ancient Israel. The king himself in ancient Israel, not just the priest, the king had to write a copy of God's law. This book, the Holy Bible. And it says in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 19, "And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal his God, and to keep all of his words," or rather, keep all the words of this law and these statutes. You look at those ceremonies. Even up as recently as 1952, you heard Zadok the priest being sung, that anthem written in the 1700s sometime. That too, based on some of these Old Testament scriptures, like God save the king. That's what they said when Solomon was crowned. You can find that as well. You can find it in the Old Testament. Well, going back to those many prophecies and the fact that Britain indeed was warned, Herbert Armstrong warned them. He was there following World War II, telling America, telling Britain that, look, we had come into the possession of roughly two-thirds of the great wealth of this world. And you, as I played in that clip earlier, you add up all of these other massive nations, some of them with populations over a billion. And even put together, they didn't even come close to the power, to the reach of the United States and Great Britain. Two brothers, Ephraim and Manasseh. Well, what did God say, though? This is all brought out in the United States and Britain in prophecy. What did he say? Once we rose to that level of power, as Mr. Armstrong went on to say in that message I just played a bit for you earlier, he went on to say, talking about America's greatness, Great Britain's greatness, a time when the two of us were great, truly were great. He said we were conquering every nation. We were winning every war for a while. But we were not serving God. And now look at us today. We're not conquering nations. We're not winning wars. And you see it in every aspect of our society. And I think that that posting at Handelsblatt really did sum it up. With a title to go with it that you could have read in the Plain Truth magazine back in the 1960s. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG or kpcg.fm if you listen online. Email us this weekend, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.